Today is what again? 15th?
16th.
16th, okay.
June 1996.
All right. 16th, and I've got about 9:40 Eastern time here, and I'm sitting here with George Mountjoy, and we've just concluded dinner, and Loretta's cleaning up after dinner, and we're too full and too happy to help out. Anyway, this is the IVS project. George was in Laos 1957-1958 and has consented to chat with me here. And basically, I've outlined that we'll go through a little bit of the form, but also start off with some different kinds of questions than what was on the form. For example, I've already prepped you on this, so you know it's coming. Either when were you born or how old are you now? And could you tell me something about your parents and your upbringing?
Okay. right now I'm 60. I was born in 1935. my family owns, still owns a 108-acre farm in Anderton County, Kentucky, which is about 60 miles, it's about 80 miles due west of here. At the time I was growing up, we were in diversified farming, meaning that we grew hogs, cattle, dairy cattle, tobacco, wheat, corn, garden crops, chickens, the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I was in my formative years, of course, farm kids were expected, as soon as they were old enough, to help with the farm work. The definitive thing of my adolescence was probably the Second World War. During the Second World War, farming was just beginning to start paying off. The Depression had ended, and money was coming in, but there was nothing to spend it for.
Yeah. Too much rationing?
Yeah, my first, until about 1948 or 1949, we actually used horsepower, and real horsepower,
right,
to do our farm work. And even after we got a tractor, my father had discovered that we could get more done with a team of horses and a tractor running than we could with just one tractor. And so, being the senior partner, he drove the tractor and I continued to use the horses. So I really knew more about, primitive agriculture than I did about modern technology.
Mm-hmm.
After graduating from high school, I didn't really consider myself an academic type, although I guess I was probably in about the upper third of my class in high school. And I went to the University of Kentucky, and not knowing what else to do, I majored in agriculture. Initially, I was drawn towards the Air Force ROTC program, probably as a result of World War II produced movies. I thought that it would be pretty neat to fly an airplane, especially if it had machine guns on it. And discovering when I was a junior, or when I was at the end of the sophomore year, one of the black days of my college career was when I found out I'd failed the flying physical and I wasn't going to be accepted for the advanced course. This kind of left me at loose ends, and I was seriously thinking about dropping out of school and enlisting in the Air Force, of course, as as an enlisted man. I figured I could work my way up. One of the NCOs that I worked around with said that, as long as you're in college, you might as well stay.
Mm-hmm.
Graduate and then try. So I listened to him and came back for the junior year. About that time, the U.S. Army Reserve moved a rifle company into Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, my hometown. And it was only about 20 miles from the University of Kentucky.
Okay.
Most of the officers in the unit were students at the university. In fact, well, the executive officer and the senior lieutenant, the company commander, had graduated from the university, and so I decided that I might as well enlist in this unit. You know, I didn't really want to be an infantryman, but I had figured that this rifle company wasn't likely to go into action anytime soon. And I also figured that the extra money I'd get for reserve meetings that helped meet college expenses, and it was kind of stylish at that time around the UK to wear items of military uniforms. You know, there were a lot of veterans there with the veterans benefit program.
The GI Bill, do you mean?
The GI Bill, and a lot of the guys in my class were Army veterans, and a lot of the others were members of this reserve unit.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the professors were officers in it, so it looked like a pretty good move. And when I graduated, 1957, nobody offered me any tremendous jobs, but one day I was reading the bulletin board at the Ag Building and saw a letter from IVS, you know, giving an advertisement, jobs, are you interested in working in a foreign country? It gave an address to write to in Washington, D.C., and so I decided to write.
Well, let me stop you for just a sec. You had an agriculture degree.
Right. I got an ag degree.
What kind of specialty? Anything?
Well,
special?
I didn't really have a specialty.
Okay, so you didn't like going to agronomy or like Loretta did entomology or anything like that?
Well, at the time, I guess I was drawn toward animal science, but I didn't like a lot of chemistry. I, like a lot of college students, I'm afraid I sort of followed the path of least resistance instead of really having a definite career choice after the Air Force kicked me out. I had noticed that I had had a good bit of fun, and I thought that the 4-H Club was a pretty neat organization. And so it looked to me like the county extension agent had a right good thing going, and so I decided I'd major. Or they didn't have a major, actually. They had what they called, specialization in extension education or in cooperative extension service work. And their idea was that the extension agent could take a whole bunch of different basic agriculture courses plus some stuff in journalism and radio hopefully, when you had all this, well, you would be able to relate agriculture to the farmers. You'd be able to write newspaper articles. You could appear on local radio and television shows and stuff like this. And there were some county agents that had come back working on their master's degree, taking the same courses as I was taking. Actually, we had some educational psychology, and I took these courses and did pretty well at them. I had mostly A's and B's, and the C's I had, what few of them there were, came from the hard science stuff like chemistry, and bacteriology 52, but somehow I wound up with about a 3.0 standing, which wasn't real good, but it wasn't real bad either.
Well, at that time, considering grade inflation, it was probably a lot better than it would be now.
Well, maybe so. But at any rate, I hadn't filled my military obligation. I'd been in the Army Reserve a couple of years, but
right.
I still had four more years to go. And at that time, they were taking, you know, they didn't have any six-month program in the Army Reserve. They were taking people for 2 years. And the extension said, well, get your military over with, and then we'll talk to you about being a county agent.
Okay.
And I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea, but I really didn't want, I'd had enough at summer camp that I knew I really probably wouldn't like being a full-time soldier. A couple or a few hours a week and a couple of weeks in the summer was okay, but going
couple
out
years
there
is different.
Doing it every day for two or three years, this didn't turn me on. And I thought, well, this looks like an opportunity.
You mean the IVS?
Yeah, IVS. You know, this looks like an opportunity to go somewhere and do something different and any kind of experience. At that, people said, well, it sounds like if you want to see what the other side of the world is like, well, this is a way to do it. And I guess it appealed to me on several fronts. You know, I knew what a military organization was like, and I knew if I went to Japan or Korea or someplace with the Army, I'd be basically a member of an Army unit, and that's where I would live and do what I did. And I kind of felt if I went with an organization like this, I'd be part of the local community, and also I felt that maybe that it would be an opportunity to serve serve the cause of world peace. I knew that it took both, but there wasn't any war going on. I knew that there was a conflict in that part of the world, and I felt like that we had a better chance maybe of doing something to resolve it by working, you know, with the local people and you know, showing them that the U.S. was maybe a better friend than the communist Chinese or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's partly patriotism, I guess, but mostly I think I wanted to go to see what the other side of the world was like. Probably joined for the wrong reasons. At least from some points of view, I was at the time. I was somewhat interested in hunting. Maybe I was a whole lot interested in hunting, and I'd always been very interested in shooting. I'd been on the UK rifle team for a couple of years while I was in school, and I thought I was a better than average rifleman at the time, and maybe I thought I was a better than average hunter, although I know now that I wasn't. But at any rate, I'd read several books and articles about Southeast Asia, mostly some stuff from a famous shooter named Charles Askins. He was an Army officer, a pistol champion, and a big game hunter. And I thought, if Askins can go to Southeast Asia and have all these adventures, why can't I?
Mm-hmm.
So those were some of the things that led me to follow up on these letters. I mean, I really didn't know what I was getting into. I'd adopted a, you know, let's go see what is there and see what happens.
Now, I'm sorry if I'm interrupting here.
But that's okay, ready to pause.
You were ready to pause, okay.
Yeah, that's...
Because I was wondering if, you know, you described some of your coursework. It sounds like you were getting yourself ready to be an extension agent.
I was. That's what I was planning to do.
And it seems to me like this... Well... Did this connect with IVS in some way?
I told them that I was... had a specialization in extension education.
For agriculture.
Yeah, I said, I guess it was agriculture because that's what my major was in.
Okay, all right.
They probably thought I was a real whiz-bang at all forms of agriculture, and the fact of the matter was that I knew a little bit about dairy farming,
mm-hmm.
and tobacco growing. And I knew a little about farming with horses and a little bit more about using tractors. I knew about how to farm on a diversified Kentucky operation, but I wasn't prepared for the kind of conditions Well, I was told that what we were doing, we were running a demonstration farm and training local young men in agricultural-related skills.
You were told this when you first joined IBS.
Well, that was the... I was told that that was the objective of the IBS project in Fong Savan, Laos.
And so that's where you were assigned, or were going to be assigned.
Yeah, so
okay.
I thought, well, this is supposedly what they've been teaching me to do at the University of Kentucky all this time.
Okay.
And my major professor thought that it would be a good experience. Of course, like I say...
So your professor saw this as future job experience, even though you wanted to see the other side of the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess people look at both sides.
Okay.
At the time, I was single. You know, I had no major responsibilities.
Good time to travel.
Except to myself. I knew that the pay wasn't all that great, but then I wasn't used to having a lot of money anyhow. Our farm was not, we weren't what you would call poor, but the reason we weren't poor was because we were very conservative in the way that we spent money. So the fact that the pay was only $60 a month, I figured that if they were providing all of your expenses, why $60 a month was more spending money than I was used to having anyhow. I was used to working all summer to have enough money to pay my way through college and pay for my food. And so, you know, this looked like, boy, you'll have a lot of money at the end of this tour. So those were some of the factors that led to my deciding to sign on with IBS.
And it was just an announcement on a bulletin board?
Yeah, just a letter on the bulletin board.
Wow.
At the agriculture building.
Oh.
And I went, we would read them. Of course, they do them, everybody puts notices on bulletin boards at colleges.
But nobody reads them normally.
Some do.
I guess you did.
I did anyway.
So I guess it does work sometimes.
Yeah. But that's how I found out. That's how I got the connection going.
Okay.
I just answered a letter.
Yeah. Now, what about training?
There was practically none.
Okay.
actually, what happened is I corresponded, and I got a pile of books from Dr. J.F. Noffsinger about the culture of Southeast Asia, including India and so forth. And I read these books. Then, on the appointed time, I think it was about late September, I got on the train and went to Washington. And I met with Dr. Noffsinger and one of his office assistants for about 3 days. You know, we had some conferences in his office, and his office assistant took me around and got me a bunch of shots and mostly it was shots, because I already had a passport, and between conferences with Dr. Noffsinger and shots and touring around through Washington visiting various agencies, I guess, maybe buying a few extra supplies. Well, I think I spent about 3 days in Washington and then got on the airplane and headed for Southeast Asia. You know, that was the training program. And
what about language?
Language, there was no, I guess the idea was that you would learn the language after you got into the, or after you got on the site.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we did have one interpreter. You know, once we got... I guess it was expected that people would hit the ground running and they would use all of their native initiative and ability to, make will make a difference, you know, once they arrive. I forget how long it, at the time, propeller-driven airplanes were state-of-the-art, and it took several days of sitting on airplanes to get all the way across the Pacific with a couple of layovers in Japan and Thailand. Started out with four-engine Constellation aircraft, and then once you got to Bangkok, you shifted to the DC-3, and in Vientiane, you switched to a single-engine aircraft called an Otter, which was adopted to the grass airfields and stuff up in northern Laos. Laos, at the time, had practically no road system. I think there were about 1,300 miles of paved road in the whole country. Mm-hmm. No railroad. The rest of the roads were graded dirt. And I think that the Army and the Highway Department, if they had one, would spend about 3 to 4 months of the dry season trying to get these roads passable. And they could use them about 2.5 months, and then the rainy season hit, and then they'd have to wait until the clouds cleared before you could get an airplane to go anywhere. So, I mean, transportation, literally the place had gone from ox carts to airplanes in 20 years or less, since the Second World War had ended. And it was a real interesting culture to look at, or to experience. As I said, there was, I guess they figured that you were supposed to learn what to do as you went along. And I realized, looking back from 40 years down the road, that I was totally unprepared, you know, for what I was facing. And furthermore, I had an inflated idea of my own abilities.
Well, what were you facing that you see now?
Well, I mean, a totally different culture, which had different values, the farming that they were doing over there was totally different from anything I had ever thought about on farming. Language, of course, they said that I picked up about as much on it as fast as anybody else that hadn't had language training. Like a lot of country kids in Kentucky, if you were taking vocational agriculture in high school, you didn't take language even if they had it. And I don't think my high school even had any language except Latin. So in college, foreign language was a non-issue as far as ag majors were concerned. So, I mean, it's basically an idea of picking up phrases in a book and practicing them, you know, as you use them and using sign language and, and whatever. How we were expected to communicate with people when we got there was, well,
Who did you live with?
Okay, well, the USOM Laos had set up the program. Now, the way the program I was on was organized.
And USOM is United States.
United States Operations Mission.
Right.
Okay. Laos. IBS and, well, all the other American assistance units in Laos were part of this.
Right.
In Phong Savan, we had about 2,000 acres of prairie set aside as a demonstration farm. The Laotian government had given this to the USOM to use for their demonstration. They had also given the IBS team the use of the city post office as a headquarters. They built a fairly good post office building with tile floors and rammed earth walls, tile roof. It's one of the more imposing buildings in a city, if
you could call Pont Savant a city. And really, it looked a whole lot like a western frontier town, except that the horses were real little and the people didn't wear Levi's and big hats. But it had kitchen racks out front. Mm-hmm. Most of the stores and other buildings didn't even have a front. I mean, they would have an overhang, and you could just, you know, walk right in them. Mm-hmm. But the post office was a pretty well-built building. We had also built some other stuff along with it. We had a mess hall put together out of solid boards. There was a sawmill somewhere around there, and we'd used or bought some lumber from it. And so we had built a mess hall had been constructed. We also had a fuel dump, and the toilet facilities were rather primitive, like back in southern Kentucky, they called it, five rooms and a path. There wasn't any running water in the building, although we did have water tanks that we could draw water out of. All the water we would boil and filter that we were going to drink because there were all kinds of microorganisms around there, and if you didn't watch out what you were eating, well, they would really do a number on most Americans. They said that I did better than most, probably because I was used to drinking water out of a well that didn't have any chlorination or other purification in it. The project buildings themselves, we had a couple of rammed earth buildings. They were made by putting up a driving post in the ground, weaving bamboo about 3 to 4 inches apart, filling this with dirt, and packing it down. Mm-hmm. The sun would dry it, and then it could be whitewashed or painted, and it would make a fairly substantial building for a little while.
Yeah.
We also had a machine shop, which had been put together out of wood with, I don't remember, I think it had a concrete floor. But buildings were, you know, relatively primitive. Sawmill technology was there, and most of them were made out of pine. Now, another thing that surprised me, I had always thought of Southeast Asia as a teeming, overpopulated region, you know, with, hordes of people trying to scratch a living out of the earth. And in upcountry Laos, this wasn't the case. Upcountry Laos was sparsely populated. It actually looked like the hill country in Oklahoma. Except that the grass wasn't nearly as nutritious and the soil was not nearly as rich. There were the remains of an ancient irrigation system. Apparently, the country had been pretty heavily settled a couple or 3,000 years before, and the land or the soil had been worn out. And as the soil and resources declined, well, the population declined and went elsewhere. I think that the concept behind the USOM project, or the IBS project, was a demonstration farm. And the original, or the first project leader, was a Kansas farmer named Ralston. He had sold his farm in Kansas, and out of humanitarian or religious motivations or whatever, had decided that he was going to make a difference. And
do you know Ralston's first name?
I don't remember.
Okay.
It's been 40 years. And
I know.
His first name, but at any rate, he had gone out, you know, armed with the best of intentions.
Mm-hmm.
He had gone up into northern Laos, to Pont Savant with a USOM guide, presumably. And he arrived in the spring as the rainy season was starting and the grass was greening up.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, according to Wallace Brown and to Frank Huffman. These were volunteers that were there when I arrived.
They had preceded you somewhat.
Frank and Carl Kopic, I think, were there with, they were some of the first that came in with Mr. Ralston.
Frank Huffman.
Yeah.
And Carl Kopic.
And Carl Kopic.
And
Wallace had come in a little bit later.
Okay.
But at any rate, according to them, Mr. Ralston had seen this green grass and these rolling hills, and he had seen Kansas in the 1840s or 50s.
Uh-huh.
You know, where it looked like a country just waiting to be opened up with modern agricultural technology.
Uh-huh.
The United States had plenty of, well, not plenty, but they had a pretty good chunk of money to spend in that part of the world.
Yeah.
They were interested in winning the hearts and minds of the people. So they gave him a blank check.
As early as 57, they're still interested.
Yeah, they gave him a blank check to set up this project, and so he ordered out a complete set of Middle West grain country farming equipment, tractors, planters, cultivators, plows, you know, the whole nine yards. And unfortunately, some time passed. The equipment got there before anyone got the technology to make a soil test. And that's when it became apparent that this wasn't going to work. Well, there were no soil tests made.
Mm-hmm.
The plan was, I've gathered, and of course I don't know this for a fact. You would have to talk to Frank or Frank probably would know more, and Paul might could tell you more if you could get with him. But the soil tests were made, and they discovered that grain country farming wasn't going to work. So the equipment was there. We ultimately tried to improve gardening. And I'm not the world's best gardener, although Clyde Searle, the chief of the party, considered himself quite a gardener. Through irrigation and through, well, a lot of hard work, well, he had managed to get a few garden plants to grow. Unfortunately, most of his garden plants were not real well accepted by the...
This was Clyde.
Yeah, by the people. Zucchini squash, I think, was his best crop. and we weren't able to set up the corn, the high-tech U.S.-style demonstration farm. We couldn't get any fertilizer. What little fertilizer could be imported by air was spent on the region's chief cash crop, which was opium.
Mm-hmm.
This opium was legal to grow and sell in the province of Sinh Huang, and every farmer grew it. It sold, I think, for about $2.10 a pound, and was exported into Thailand by light aircraft. And there was another connection there. At one end of Phong Savan, the main street of the city, by the way, was about half a mile, maybe less.
Mm-hmm.
The USOM project was at one end of the street, and at the other end of the street was a French community called the Bungalow. It was supposedly a hotel. It was run by a French soldier of fortune named Lebonski, an ex-French Foreign Legionnaire. He had several hangers-on down there, including a couple of young men that flew his two airplanes.
So he was the one taking the opium to Thailand?
They were Cessna 140s.
Uh-huh.
And Lebonski would deal with the locals, buy the opium.
Mm-hmm.
It would go in these planes, and they would fly it into Thailand and land at secret airfields. I understand that they had greased the Thai government's people pretty liberally with money to make sure that they didn't take too many of their planes. If they did take an airplane, the bail for the pilot was already paid. The pilot would keep the plane, but the pilot would be released, which that would be the only way I would fly one of these things. But at any rate, that was the main cash crop, and obviously we couldn't give any advice or technical assistance on growing opium. Besides that, we didn't know a darn thing about cultivating.
Yeah,
in the
they could have taught you.
So, rice farming, of course, they grew a lot of rice at one time. Well, we eventually did some assistance, you know, on plowing rice paddies. Our tractors could plow rice paddies a lot faster than their ox or their buffalo. And this is one of the things that we actually did to help the people. We did have sick call. We had a nurse attached. Her name was Martha Rupel, and she was a real professional in humanitarian service. She had cut her teeth during the Spanish Civil War as a nurse just out of college.
Really?
Yeah, she had gone over there with the American Friends to help people during the Civil War. And and she had spent the Second World War in humanitarian work of one kind or another, and she just sort of kept on doing this.
During which Civil War?
Well, she was a nurse.
But which Civil War?
The Spanish Civil War in 1937.
Oh, okay, all right. Okay, I'm sorry.
when the fascists and the communists.
Right, yeah.
She was sort of a member of the Medical International Brigade.
Oh.
But
wow.
At any rate, they had sick call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would,
was she also IBS or was
assigned to the project.
Oh, okay. Because you mentioned these four guys. Well, yourself.
And Martha.
And Martha's the fifth.
Yeah, and then Clyde. And that was it.
So the five of you.
For the time being.
Yeah, okay.
And at any rate, they'd do sick call and outlaying villages, too.
Okay.
We'd go to one village one day and... It's mostly a matter of pushing pills and treating infections. I mean, limited stuff that a nurse could do, but she was still best medical best medic that they had.
Sure.
it was real, I guess you could call it was really a shock, you know, seeing the kinds of conditions that people were living in that area. And the kinds of things that they had to put up with. But we would, you know, Martha would load up and she'd spend 2 or 3 days a week, you know, visiting various villages and having sick call. And the rest of the time, well, she'd do, sick call there in Ponksevon. And
right.
Our headquarters was in the village. The project itself was about 4 miles out in the country, or out beyond it. And we'd put it mostly under fence. As a matter of fact, we had all of it under fence eventually. Several things that we couldn't get fertilizer, at least not in enough quantities to make grain farming practical. We got a little fertilizer for gardens. One of the things that was tried was improving local livestock through upgrading them.
You mentioned the bulls.
Yeah, bulls and chickens both.
Right. Then the Rhode Island Reds.
Yeah, we got a whole airplane load of Rhode Island Red and Leghorn chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And these chickens were not really, there were lots of microorganisms that could work on them too.
Sure.
Their mortality rate was pretty good or pretty high.
Yeah,
and you'd maybe lose one every 2 or 3 days. But we would trade the eggs from these chickens for local eggs. Supposedly, you took the eggs from the American chickens put them under the Laotian hens.
Oh.
And then we would eat the eggs that we had traded for.
Right.
Theoretically, the little chicks would hatch out and they would have improved American chickens. Unfortunately, as far as I know, none of these chickens ever survived.
Oh, really? They wouldn't make it.
Their mortality was about 100%. Some of them would live for several weeks, but eventually the American chickens apparently just didn't have what it took to
survive.
Make it on local, under the local conditions.
Mm-hmm.
The bulls did a little bit better. We had about 1,000 acres
mm-hmm.
under fence, and the bulls went in here. And these were range bulls, I guess, from either Texas, from Texas and Oklahoma. Again, they had been donated by a philanthropic Texas rancher and flown at great expense to Southeast Asia.
This guy Jenkins?
Yeah, these bulls came in on a C-47 airplane. And that's the only way they could get there.
Uh-huh. But it was Jenkins that paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right.
Anyway, their pasture was fenced, but the grass wasn't good enough or nutritious enough to keep these bulls going.
Mm-hmm.
We did buy rice and gave them supplemental feeding on this. And, of course, the villagers couldn't afford to feed rice to their cattle. They had to save it to eat themselves.
Sure.
This is where I really ran into problems with a different culture, because I had been trained to look at a cow and see meat or milk. Obviously, milking any of these cows was impossible. Now, there was a fairly sparse human population, but there was a pretty good cattle population in this area. It was mostly small holdings, farms, prairie. There were several different cultures there. There were the Mao. These were hill people that basically practiced a little livestock farming and a little agriculture, and grew opium as their chief cash crop.
Mm-hmm.
These folks were hard-working. Their villages were palisaded, kind of like a old Kentucky frontier community. The palisades were not to keep out the Indians. They were to keep out predators that might come in and kill their chickens and little pigs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they had the same type of palisades around them as you would see in a movie set on the Kentucky frontier in the
mm-hmm.
1700s. the only way to get to these villages was by horse or walking. Most of them were set way out in the hills, and if you visited them, you either rode a horse or you hoofed it. Now, on the prairie, the Laotians the Mao were mostly Catholic, or some of them were Protestant. There were several Catholic missionaries and some Protestant missionaries in the area. And they found that the Mao were fairly easy to convert to Christianity.
Hmm.
Now, the Laotians, the ones that lived in Ponsavan and out on the prairie, around it, most of them were Buddhists, and they didn't convert very well because they had a much Mao, I think, had originally had a sort of an animism with their main religion, and they didn't have much of a theology, and so it was relatively easy, I guess, to convert them.
Yeah.
The Buddhists, of course, had a much more well-developed faith, and so the Protestant missionaries and the Catholic missionaries didn't have nearly as good a luck with them.
Did you fraternize with the missionaries at all?
Oh, yes. You mean the missionaries?
Yeah.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the missionary in Seeing Quang, Ted Andrianoff was probably one of our best friends.
He was what, Protestant?
Yeah, well, he's a member of an organization called the CMA, or Christian Missionary Alliance. This is a very fundamental, well, I guess you could call it it's a very fundamentalist type religious organization. I mean, it makes the Southern Baptists look very liberal. They did not, for instance, believe in dancing or drinking.
Oh, gee.
A lot of the other stuff,
uh-huh.
or movies. You know, they... But real religious, not that it mattered because you couldn't do any of these things in that area anyhow.
No dance halls.
I came on the ship home. I traveled with one of the CMA missionaries that was going home after a 5-year tour, and I found out they did believe in hunting, however, because he, in his section, he did quite a bit of hunting to put meat on the pot, you know, for his family. I mean, he had a shotgun and used it extensively out in the jungle. But Ted, of course, Seeing Quang, since it was high prairie and pretty poor soil, there really wasn't much wild game.
Yeah,
in that area.
No, not at all.
One of the reasons there wasn't much wild game in the area had to do with the aftermath of the French, well, of the Civil War that had ended in 1953, I believe. When the French left Indochina, they knew that the communists were planning to take it over. So. They left all of their surplus small arms and all of the extra ammunition that they had.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these guns were not, you know, they weren't top line, but they were certainly effective enough to shoot any deer or wild buffalo or anything else like that that happened to be in the area. And most of these little villages, the Mao villages, you would visit them, and they would have skulls of these wild buffalo that I had been planning to shoot hanging on the walls with 5 or 6 holes bored right through the center of the head. So the old bolt-action French Model 36 rifles had been effective enough for the buffalo anyway. They'd shot most of their ammunition off by the time we got there, but they had sure taken out most of the wildlife while they were doing it. The other hunters, they used a crossbow, which shot bamboo arrows. These were kind of fun, but not real effective, except on very small birds and stuff like that. Most of the a lot of the locals had homemade muzzleloaders, and these make a Kentucky long rifle look like the top technology. They were made with the locks were made out of leaf springs from Jeeps that had been cut and shaped. They were all open. You know, the springs and everything were completely visible. You know, where the modern, an American muzzle loader will have a lock plate with everything on the inside, the lock plates on these, they just bolted the stuff on so that you could actually see it. They did use a flint ignition system, and they would shoot. They made their own black gunpowder with sulfur, saltpeter, and charcoal. Again, they weren't very accurate, and with the exception of maybe small birds and little squirrels and stuff, you couldn't take much with them, but there were a lot of them around there. So it was a real good example in my modern role as a hunter training officer, where I can use Indochina as an example of what happens in a country where you have a lot of guns and no game laws or hunting seasons or anybody to enforce them. There just wasn't really any game to speak of in that part of the country.
And So you had all the game, and then you introduced these state-of-the-art weapons, and wham, all the wildlife is gone.
Yeah. The French had left them. Now, their intention was that they were going to use these guns to protect themselves against the communists when they came through. And ultimately, it was probably a good idea, but by that time, I understand the U.S. government had issued them M16s, along with Special Forces 18 members to show them how to use them. I remember later, I guess it was about 1965 or 6, I was watching a TV show about Laos, and they had a kid from this very same province. He was about 12 years old, and he was carrying an M16 rifle. And one of the reporters had asked the American in charge, and I don't really know what he was. He was a member of USOM, probably a soldier. What he would think... If you ask him, did you have any children? And yes, he had a couple. How old were they? 12, 15. What would you think if some soldier came and gave your son a rifle
like this?
And he said, if it was the Petit Lao coming, I would praise the Lord that he was there. So the Petit Lao, I think, fought the communists. They fought the Japanese. I understand that the Japanese, who had occupied French Indochina during the Second World War, had never been able to establish a real presence in that part of the country because the Mao were supplied with U.S. equipment by air, and they made it hot for any Japanese patrols that tried to move through. And they just didn't have the manpower. But anyway, that's most of what we did. These bulls, by the way, we fed them their rice ration.
Yeah, we're on that.
To keep them from starving to death. And they would get pretty frisky. The fence posts that we had put in the ground were pretty well infested with termites. And
sure,
it wasn't much of a trick for one of these Brahma bulls to break down a few fence posts and take off any time he wanted to. So usually two or three of them would be out roaming. And we'd generally try to keep as good a track on them as we could. And when they got a little bit worn down, well, we'd try to round them up and get them back into the fence, back under our fence. working wild range cattle with a Jeep and on foot is kind of dangerous. It's an exciting activity because these bulls weren't trained to relate to people on foot. One of them, in fact, when I was trying to haze him back onto the pasture, decided he was going to go where I was. He lowered his head and charged.
You.
And I got quite a reputation as a bullfighter. They said that I'd done a pretty good job of standing my ground and then getting out of his way when he came by.
When you had to.
If I'd had a cape, well, it would have worked pretty well. But at any rate, we didn't really do much on the upgrading of the livestock.
Well, when they were out.
Well, when they were out, I'm sure that they did what they could for the local cattle. But the local cattle, food was so scarce for them, and the grass was so poor in quality that most of the local livestock were basically skin and bones.
Anyway.
I mean, they would look, they'd make a Texas Longhorn look fat by comparison.
Really?
one of my ideas, the range seemed to be overstocked as far as I could tell. And granted, I wasn't used to range cattle. I knew a little about it from reading, and I had studied it at Southern College, but one of my theories was that all this extra livestock could be maybe converted into meat, you know, and sold for profit to improve the local economy if people would just get together and do it. But when I ran this idea past Ted Andrianoff, the missionary, he said it'd never go. He told me that even the Christians were close enough to the Buddhist faith that they would not kill a young, healthy animal. The animals that they killed, you know, for their boons or these, that's what they called a party over there with a boon. And they would get one that was kind of old and sick and knock it in the head because they figured it was about to die and pass on into the next stage anyway, and it would forgive them. But they would not think very well of somebody taking out a two-year-old, you know, nice tender one.
Yeah.
I kept wondering, why is all the meat at these boons so tough and stringy?
That, that was a good reason.
I didn't do much. That was one of my major ideas for improving the economy. And,
and it wasn't going to work.
It didn't fly.
I was wondering about something in terms of one thing you wrote here and then what you just said about this man Jenkins. He was like a philanthropist and got you up and running. And here you were also saying, though, that a lot of the money for the project came from AID funds. Through the PEO. So,
well, they were getting some, the cattle and some of the other, I think that the cattle were the main thing that were sent over. The cattle were donated, but the transportation
was AID.
Yeah, transporting six Brahma bulls from Oklahoma
to
Laos. This was U.S.
Okay, and all the funds to keep things going on the day-by-day basis was AID.
Actually, we were being supported by the USOM. You know, they were sending our food and our gasoline, our tools, you know, the machinery.
Yeah.
You know, what happened is that IBS got a grant.
Okay.
You know, from USOM.
For this project.
Right. That's what was funding it.
Okay.
They were getting, I think at the time, there was something like $42 million a year in U.S. aid was going into Laos. Of the $42 million, about $38 to $39 million was an undercover funding of military aid.
Were you in that, or yours was more above
board? Our mission was to... I thought about that a lot, and I decided that although the project wasn't doing what it was really supposed to do, nobody up the line, with the exception of Dr. Nofsinger and maybe Clyde Cyril, really cared, because we were an example of non-military assistance. We were showing the American flag in Ponsavan, you know, the fact that there was an American team on the scene that was working to improve the local economy, however inefficiently, looked good. And people would come out from the U.S. Information Service, you know, they could visit the place. And it was a very popular place to come to because Vid John was lowland with mosquitoes, heat, you know, all the disadvantage of a tropical country. And Phong Savan was about 4,500 feet elevation up in the mountains. Up there most of the time. The
nice and cool.
Pretty, well, low humidity. Temperatures were relatively pleasant. Winter day, you might get down to about 35 degrees in the morning and up to about 75 or 80 by noon.
That's wonderful.
So, I mean, we were real popular. People would come up there.
Especially during the hot seasons.
Yeah, to get away from Vientiane and the compound down there.
Right.
They'd supply the money.
But it sounds almost, and I'm going to put it in a way that sounds negative, but it's almost as if they were happy that it, from what I hear you saying, and tell me if I'm wrong, that they were happy with this because it was good PR.
Well, they were, I won't say they were happy, but they were satisfied.
Okay, yeah.
They would have been happier
if it had worked
if
real
we
well.
We had been able to have done it like Ralston envisioned.
Okay.
But they were satisfied with what was going on
mm-hmm.
because
they could show that, and they didn't have to talk about the $38 billion going into the military.
And we were hearing
mm-hmm.
the hardships of the people, and we were, in our way, we were doing some good. We were...
I'm not trying to say... Yeah, I was putting it very negative.
We were helping some on road construction. We were giving some medical
mm-hmm.
assistance to the people.
You were teaching English?
out there... Well, actually winning friends and,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the locals, liked having the Americans around.
Sure.
Nobody, there weren't any real communists there that I saw. As a matter of fact, Ponsavan had quite a group of refugees from Hanoi in North Vietnam.
Oh.
People that
Vietnamese.
Left Hanoi and... migrated south to stay away from the communist regime.
Uh-huh.
One of them was a town photographer. He was a pretty good friend of ours. I forget his name right now, but I do have a picture of him somewhere or other. And he had several pictures of me, but at any rate, he had, and his family, when the communist regime took over in North Vietnam, they were relatively wealthy. And they abandoned their business and walked out of there with just what they could carry and settled in Ponsavan and started up business again with box cameras and whatever
mm-hmm.
because they didn't want to live in Hanoi under the communist government. And there were several other people that had done the same thing. So they were... very much in favor of the American presence.
Uh-huh.
And if there were any hardcore communists in the area, I didn't know anything about them.
Yeah, yeah.
Lebonsky, of course, was the free enterprise type. They probably liked him as much as they did us because he gave them money for their major cash crop.
Oh, the drug runner.
French.
Yes, yeah, the French guy, yeah.
Because it was legal. And it was, we have somewhere pictures of the refining process, how to cut the...